clear channel type of organization where, you know, you're cast out. You're in. If you're in Houston, and probably if you're on the road and coming through Houston, you're probably more than invited to come to the studio. So it's just a great place to get your music out there, and I think it's a great place to be a music listener as well.
Listen for his music and other local artists here on KPFT.
Hi there, I'm Luba Dvorak, singer-songwriter here in Houston, Texas. You're listening to KPFT Houston.
Hi, this is Clint Broussard from Blues and Hi-Fi, and you are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston.
That is the percolating beat of Ray Lynch's Clouds Below Your Knees. And it's time for So What's Your Story. We're the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to stories and the art of telling them. Right here on KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston's community radio.
Our program, So What's Your Story, has been on the air since 2008. That's 15 years. Over that time, we've brought over 500 storytellers, folks just like you, ordinary people with extraordinary stories to tell. And we're in a major KPFT fund drive. So to help keep our program going, along with all the great programming on KPFT, please consider donating. Call 713-526-5738, which is also 713-JAM-KPFT, or you can go to kpft.org. And when you call or go online, please designate So What's Your Story as the show you support.
Well, I'm your host today, Eric Heen, backed up by the most talented team on radio. And today's guest is a very accomplished storyteller. And when you hear him, you're going to say, why the hell didn't you get this guy on sooner? Our guest is Mark Binder. Let me tell you about Mark. Mark has been called a master at spinning old tales and everyday events linked to childhood into storytelling gold. He's also the award-winning author of several books and audiobooks, including the Village Life series, written under the pen name of Izzy Abramson. Hey, Mark, I know you're a really busy guy, so thanks for taking the time to be on our show.
It's a real pleasure. It's nice to be back in Texas.
Ah, yes. Mark, I see here that you tell stories, all kinds of stories, for many years. Is there any specific type of stories or storytelling that you specialize in?
No. I like to say I specialize in diversity. I really tell a wide variety of stories, from traditional folk tales to tall tales, to original tall tales, to original folk tales, to autobiographical fiction, to fantastic lies. Yeah. And then, of course, there's the whole Village Life series of stories as well, that's both within and outside of a tradition. So a lot of different things.
Right. Because at first glance, from looking at your work, the humor aspect really stands out, but there's more serious elements in your work as well. It's not entirely humor. Is that correct?
Yes. One of my missions as a performer, in fact, sort of the key mission that's somewhat in the background, is transmitting joy. I believe that joy is something that can only be created. We can create joy for ourselves, and we can receive joy from other people in a visceral way, face to face. And that's one of my background goals whenever I'm telling stories live. I don't think joy can be transmitted so well, even on the radio or television, all those things. You can get a hit of it, a small taste of it. Mm-hmm. But there's something visceral about joy that doesn't communicate as well digitally or And within that, it means that most of my material tends to be upbeat. Mm-hmm. People don't really want to go out and hear dark stories. Certainly not young people. They don't really want to hear dark stories. Sure. It's sometimes possible to frame the darkness inside of something, but it's challenging.
Right.
So the answer is yes. I do go into the dark and the edgy. And on the other hand, you know, let's face it, the story of Jack and the Beanstalk, which I've told a million times, gets a ton of laughs, is about a murderer and a thief who's the hero.
Ah, yes.
So
there's a lot of morbidity in those old tales.
There is.
Yeah, I was reading these original Grimm's tales way back then. They're like cannibalism, the witch crunching the bone. it calmed them down over the years.
They're very visceral. I used to tell Hansel and Gretel at Halloween, pretty much the straight Grimm's version. And you have to warn parents that this is not going. And parents these days are, it's a roll of the dice when you're in a family situation, how far you can go,
right?
Because the kids won't mind, the parents will freak out.
Yeah.
So the goal is to walk this little tightrope.
Yeah, exactly.
And
we've been talking about your stories. Now let's hear some.
Okay.
Let's hear your first story.
Well, I'm going to introduce it with a little bit of music, and then we'll go into the story.
Great.
On the edge of the Black Forest, somewhere between Russia and Poland, and occasionally Germany, not far from Ukraine, is a small Jewish village called Chelm. 80 or so houses, more chickens than people, the village is a community of laughter and love, arguments, complaints, reconciliations, more complaints, problems. Are there problems? Of course there are problems. What would life be like without problems? Well, as wise Rabbi Kibitz said, it would be nice for a little while. It was the Hanukkah after Rabbi Kibitz married Mrs. Chaipul. She was the caterer. They'd known each other forever. He had been widowed. She had been widowed. They finally managed to get married. And a delegation came to the rabbi. Reb Cantor the merchant led off. Rabbi Kibitz. Yes? It's about your wife's latkes. I know. If you don't know what a potato latke is, a potato latke is a potato pancake fried in oil in celebration of the holiday of Hanukkah, which happens in December, usually. Most of the time it's in December, sometimes it's November, sometimes it's early, sometimes it's late. If you've never had a potato pancake, and I know people in Texas often have because you've got a German population there. If you've never had a potato pancake, think of McDonald's hash brown, but homemade and better, except for Mrs. Chaipul's latkes. Mrs. Chaipul was a phenomenal cook. She could make a brisket that was so tender, the meat would fall apart. Her matzo ball soup was delicious, although the matzo balls themselves, well, that's a completely different story. Her kugel was phenomenal, and everyone always went to her restaurant, but you never complained because she owned the only restaurant in the village. And if she kicked you out of the restaurant, you had to go to the next town over, Smyrna, anytime you wanted to eat out. I know, Rabbi Kibitz said. He had been eating his wife's Mrs. Chaipul's latkes, now his wife's latkes, for years and years and years. It wasn't that they were too salty, which they were. It wasn't that they were too greasy, which they could be. It wasn't that they were overdone, which sometimes they were. It was the smell. There was a smell about, you know that thing that died in the cellar and you still can't find it. There was just this odor of the latkes. And what he used to do is she would pile his plate high because he was the rabbi and she was the caterer. She would pile his plate high. He would sneak out back. He would feed his latkes to the goats, and sometimes the goats would get sick. I know, Rabbi Kibitz said. This is the sort of thing that a husband should be able to talk to his wife about. I'll talk to her. He was wrong. He got home that evening. He walked in the house. He said, Chana, listen, it's about your latkes. What about my latkes? Well, I've been thinking, you've been making latkes for so many years. It's at the Hanukkah party. It's a wonderful tradition, but perhaps somebody else could pick up the mantle and do it this year. She looked at him. She said, you don't like my latkes? No, I didn't say that. What I mean is that we're getting on in years. You know, we're both looking towards retirement maybe in a few years. Perhaps we could train something. You don't like my latkes? I didn't say that. It's just that as things go, new things have to come in. You don't like my latkes? You can sleep on the floor. She walked into the bedroom. A pillow came flying out, hit him in the head, and the door slammed. And poor Rabbi Kibitz was forced to sleep under the kitchen table for the whole week. Finally, at last, the Hanukkah party was coming. And he thought about staying home because he knew where she would be, and at least he could get in some rest. But he decided that a rabbi's place was with his congregation. So he went to the social hall and he stood outside. He took a whole bunch of deep breaths. He inhaled, and he walked into the room, holding his breath. For as long as he could, he waved, he shook hands, he smiled, he patted people on the backs. He held his breath for as long as he could, and finally he had to exhale. He was dreading the next moment when... Oh, it smelled good. He looked around, and he saw... In the kitchen was Mrs. Rosen and her daughter, and they were cooking the latkes. There was a line from the kitchen snaking throughout the entire social hall, all the way to the back of the social hall. People were getting their plates full of latkes. They were walking to the back of the line and eating standing up. He got into line. He got to the front. They gave him a plate full of latkes, and they were so beautiful. They were perfectly round with a golden center and brown, crispy lace edges. And the smell was delicious. He looked around for a place to sit, but the only table that he saw had his wife right across from the empty seat. He walked over and he sat down. He smiled. He picked up his fork. He cut into it. It broke beautifully. He lifted it up to his lips. He put it into his mouth. He closed his eyes and he began to chew. Just then, Reb Cantor came over and slapped him on the back. So, Rabbi Kibitz, what do you think of the latkes this year? He chewed very, very slowly. He swallowed and finally said, well, Mrs. Rosen and her daughter's latkes are pretty good, but I like my wife's better. Everyone in the social hall broke out in laughter. They didn't notice that Rabbi Kibitz didn't finish his plate. He got up and he left and he headed home to get some rest before she came home. He had fallen asleep and he heard the door slam. He grabbed his pillow. He sat up and his wife came into the room and said, no, you can stay. It was nice what you said about my latkes. Mrs. Rosen's are better. I'm going to get the recipe so that next year I can make them. She gave him a kiss on the cheek, and they went to sleep. Well, Rabbi Kibitz, he didn't fall asleep right away because he was thinking about it. He didn't lie to anyone. Her latkes were better because they were made with her love.
Uh-huh.
And that is the story of the lethal latkes.
Yes.
That's from the book. It's actually in two of my books. It's from A Village Romance, which is the story of the relationship between Rabbi Kibitz and Mrs. Heiple. And it's also in Winter Blessings. The same as a storyteller, you know that stories in different contexts have different meanings. And it's such a good story that.
I've started reading Village Feasts. And, I could tell, those characters are also in Village Feasts.
Yes.
Jaipul, yes, Rabbi Kibitz, Reb Cantor, is it?
Reb Cantor, yep.
Yeah, and I noticed, Mark, that food features quite prominently in your stories. So what is it about food that makes it good food for stories?
It's something that everybody knows and loves, and it's something that really connects. I mean, people connect food with good memories, they connect food with bad memories. And so much, it all depends on who you are and where you live, but there's so much mediocre food in our world that telling stories about wonderful food or telling stories about horrific food are just interesting and fun. And they make people salivate and also I'm a cook, so I do a lot of cooking, so it sort of comes naturally.
Yeah, well, food is something we can all relate
to. It is. This in the Village Feasts, there's the story of the Mrs. Heipel's lead shot put matzo balls is in that book. It's also in A Village Romance. Those two stories are in both books, which is kind of weird. And I always like to say that those books have bonus stories because I threw a couple of extra stories from the other book into it.
Right. Well, I've read about her matzo balls.
Yes.
That was hilarious.
Thank you.
As a matter of fact, my wife got a little upset with me. I was reading it late at night. She said, "What are you laughing? You're keeping me up laughing." It was Ms. Chipol's matzo balls.
Yes, they are delicious and long lasting.
Mm-hmm. Well, now what is this? The Village Life series, is that like several of these books are in a series? Is that how it
Yes. works? So I began. I tend to talk in circles, so we're going to just sort of spiral around a little bit. Izzy Abramson is a pen name that I use for these books, and it's a combination of Jewish people have, I'm Jewish, I really believe it, as you're not Jewish and you're enjoying the stories, these are stories that are Jewish stories that are written for anyone, in the same way that, Faulkner is, you don't have to be Southern to read Faulkner. I'm not as serious as Faulkner in general, but so my Hebrew name is Isaac, hence Izzy, and my father's Hebrew name is Abraham. So Izzy Abramson became my pen name for this series. And as a storyteller, what I do is I say, these are Izzy Abramson's tales of village life. As a writer, I'm maintaining the pen name because people buy books by brand, and Mark Binder writes these books called It Ate My Sister and The Zombie Cat or The Groston Rules, and throwing in, A Village Romance just makes consumers nuts. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's not even the consumers, maybe it's just the algorithms. We all are working with algorithms these days. So the Village Life series began, 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. I was the editor of the Rhode Island Jewish Herald newspaper back in the day when Rhode Island, the smallest state in the union, had two Jewish newspapers. Ours was actually for profit, believe it or not. And one day, it was a weekly newspaper, and one Wednesday morning, somebody didn't turn in their article that was assigned. And in those days, it was much harder to steal stuff from the internet. So I sat down and I wrote my first Village Life story. Mm-hmm. And interesting, if you go to the izzyabe.com podcast, you can hear that story. It actually was only printed that once, and it's not in any of the books yet. And in fact, the main character, that story was called How the Cantor Lost His Voice. And a cantor is a singer in the synagogue, sort of like the choir master. And that cantor, not to be confused with Reb Cantor, the merchant, he never appeared in any other stories. He got so embarrassed and he left the village and never returned. So I began writing those stories. And then I left the newspaper and began selling those stories to newspapers around the world, one of which happens to be the Houston Jewish Voice newspaper.
Right, right.
And Vicki Samuels was the editor at the time, and she was buying all of my stories. And I said to her, hey, what if I wrote a novel? And she said, okay. And I don't think she really thought I was being serious. So I was going to do a serialization, you know, the way Dickens used to do, or Dostoevsky, again, funnier than both of those. Although, so I began to serialize. It was then called The Brothers Schlemiel. So anybody who's listening who might have read The Brothers Schlemiel by Mark Binder, it's being republished this fall as The Village Twins by Izzy Abramson. Same book, fewer typos. And I began writing that one episode a week for the next 2 years.
Now, Mark, are these stories, are they sort of retellings, reinterpretations of old, like the folk tradition type thing? Are these originals?
They are original. They have a feeling of folk.
They do.
And I mean, I majored in storytelling, actually mythology at Columbia University, and have absorbed sort of lots of different stories from all around the world. But I'm also, but I like making things up. That's just the fact. I love making things up, and I love creating these narratives. For example, The Village Twin. So all of these books can be read in any order. Mm-hmm. Right now there are actually two more books that are coming out later that are meant to be read later, but The Village Twins could be read first, or The Village Romance, either one of those.
Right. But there's a lot of overlaps, same characters, same
sounds. Well, they're actually happening all at the same time. Mm-hmm. So the time frame overlaps. In the book that you've got, The Village Feasts, there's a story that happens after the entire Village Twins book.
Oh, okay.
So back to your question about are they... So the village is a village called Chelm. And in Jewish storytelling tradition, really, and Jewish literature, Chelm is... a joke town. It's a place of fools, a village of fools.
Now, Mark, there is a story about the origins of the town of Chelm.
I think which one have you heard?
Okay, God himself sent an angel down to earth with this big bag full of foolish souls. And he told this angel to just sprinkle a few fools here and there all over the world, just so there's one here and there. This angel, somewhere in Poland, I think it was, she stumbled, fell down, and dumped all these foolish souls on one place, and that place became the town of Chelm. Is that the true origins, or am I getting it wrong?
Well, that is one story of the village of Chelm. My village, the one that I own and create, I have the pleasure and arrogance of saying includes all of those stories. However, Rabbi Kibitz's great-grandfather, who was also called Rabbi Kibitz, was actually the founder of my village of Chelm. He and a bunch of people were wandering around looking for a place to live, and they got lost in the Black Forest, as often happened. It was cold. They were tired of camping out. Rabbi Kibitz's great-great-grandfather, Rabbi Kibitz, had a cold. He sneezed with a loud sound of Chelm. This piece of phlegm went flying out of his mouth, hit a big oak tree. He said, that is where we are going to build the synagogue, and we're going to use that tree as the door.
Uh-huh.
And so there's a discoloration on the door of their synagogue where the ancient rabbis Chelm phlegm landed, and that's
so,
the origin.
So in your Chelm, Mark, there was no angel involved.
No, I'm a fairly secular person. I don't practice religion. There's a certain amount of spirituality in these stories. There is a certain amount of religion because these characters are living in a religious community.
Sure.
But the books are not about the nuts and bolts of the Jewish traditions or the Jewish religion. The books are about the people who live inside of this village.
Right. Well, I do got to say, though, Mark, these stories are quite educational for us goyish, non-Jewish guys. You know, learn about Seder, the Seder during Hanukkah, is it?
The Seder, yeah.
The Seder, yeah.
That's okay.
And the food and everything. So it is educational as yes. far as Jewish culture is concerned.
It's Jewish culture filtered through my little brain. So like every culture these days, I mean, there are so many, any particular culture, if you go to different churches, I'm sure in your community, some people have this kind of tuna salad and some people have that kind of tuna salad. And if you put them in a contest, they would, you know, that's how things are.
Right.
Well, we're going to take a break from our show now for station identification and to make a few announcements. This is Eric Heen, and you're listening to So What's Your Story on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 for our friends in Huntsville. Our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, meets the fourth Tuesday of every month for story swaps, and everyone is invited to those. And you can find out all about the Houston Storytellers Guild at their website, houstonstorytellers.org. And don't forget our friends at the Moth Storytelling Organization. They hold Story Slams the second Tuesday of every month down at the Warehouse Live. And our program, So What's Your Story, is aired here on KPFT every Thursday at 5 p.m. And we also have a Facebook page called So What's Your Story, so be sure to go there and check us out.
And I'd like to remind you, we are in the midst of our KPFT fund drive. So please call 713-526-5738 with your donation, or you can go to kpft.org to support public radio. And when you donate, you can designate our show, So What's Your Story, to help us along our way.
And now let's get back to our show. Our guest today is Mark Binder.
Well, Mark, I know you got tons of stories, so let's hear another one.
And as the wise men of the Python troupe Monty said, and now for something completely different.
Okay.
way back before the Nintendo, the Xbox, the Game Boy, the PlayStation, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, before there were laptops, before there were DVDs, before there were VCRs, before cable TV, before cell phones, before my family had a color TV, they used to call me the PI kid. It happened on an overnight camping trip. There were 12 campers and two counselors, and we were hiking through the woods. We were going to the old deserted Crosby Barn where we were going to tell scary stories until late in the night. I mean, we were hiking along, singing the song, 100 bottles of beer on a wall, 100. When I do this in schools, by the way, to those of you who are out there listening, when I tell the story in schools, I don't say 100 bottles of beer on the wall. That'll just freak people out. So I change it to 100 bottles of pop. But let's be honest, we sang 100 bottles of beer on the wall and we were 12 years old and we didn't become alcoholics.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, 100 bottles of beer on the wall, 100 bottles of beer, take one down, pass one. We walked and we walked and we walked until we came to the John Henry Ford across the Breakneck River. Now, a ford is a shallow part of a river where you can walk across, right? So we took off our shoes and we took off our socks and we're walking across the river. And all of a sudden, the counselor in front, his name is Maddie. And Maddie was real old. He must have been like 20. And he always wore a cowboy hat and he had a little thin mustache and a goatee. And we thought he was part Native American because he was always so quiet. He said, "Poison Ivy." "What?" The counselor in the back's name was The House. And The House was big and fat. And we called him The House because of the Wizard of Oz. If he sat on you, he would crush you. "What?" "Poison Ivy. Just about the biggest patch I ever seen." And we looked across the river and there was poison ivy all up and down the other bank of the river. Now, if you don't know what poison ivy looks like, it's It's got three leaves, one sticking up and one to each side. In the early summer, it's bright green and shiny, but towards the end of summer, since was, it gets red and green and shiny. It's really pretty. Oh, bug breath. All right, everybody, turn around. We got to go to the next ford. It's about 2.5 miles upstream. And everybody went, oh, because, you know, you go 2.5 miles upstream and you cross the river. You got to come back 2.5 miles just to get to where you were. Everybody else turned around and started to head back, except for me. See, I knew I was immune to the effects of poison ivy. Poison ivy is an allergy. You get it on your skin and you break out in a rash. And some people are allergic. Most people are allergic. Me, I wasn't allergic. I had played in the woods where everybody else played. Everybody at camp had gotten poison ivy except me. So I kept going. And Maddie's like, where are you going? I'm going to go over there. I'll wait for you guys to come back down. I'm immune to the effects of poison ivy. He looked at me. Are you serious? I was like, yeah, I'm serious, Maddie. I won't go wandering off. I promise. He said, all right. And they took off and they left me there. You can tell this story happened a long, long time ago. They just left me there in the middle of the woods all by myself. It was actually kind of nice being off by myself in the middle of the woods. I looked around and I realized they were going to be a while. They had to go 2.5 miles upstream, cross the river, come 2.5 miles down. And I was getting a little bit tired, so I decided to take a nap. I was looking for a place to lie down. Now, the trail was all rocky, and the woods were full of tree roots. But that poison ivy patch, it was thick. It looked pretty comfy. So I took off my shirt, and I used it as a pillow, and I rolled around. I got kind of comfy, and I fell fast asleep. A couple hours later, I heard them coming down the trail. 14 miles of pop on the wall. 14. I jumped up. Hey, guys, how you doing? They're like, oh, man, they were peeved. They were tired. They were cranky. They were all scratched up. There had been a briar patch, you know, pricker bushes on the other side of that ford. Anyway, we got to the old deserted Crosby barn, and we started to tell scary, scary stories until late in the night. Now, I'm not going to tell you the scary stories, because the scary story that goes here is what you call a jump tale. And you don't tell jump tales on the radio because they cause car accidents. Okay. But if you want to see some of the scary stories in the book, It Ate My Sister, there's this story called Running Head that is really, really freaky. Anyway, Maddie, he told these stories about guys with hooks for hands, you know, coming up on the couple who were making out in the car, and they drove off at the last moment, and there was a hook hanging from the latch of the car, and old ladies burning their families in barns, and we went to bed completely freaked out. It was hard to fall asleep. And then in the middle of the night, I heard this voice off in the distance. Fire, fire. I jumped up. I started yelling, fire, fire. My tent mate, David, he's yelling, fire. You ever jump up inside a pup tent and your head hits the roof? Anyway, we jump out of the tent. Everybody's now is running around the campground yelling, fire, fire, fire. All of a sudden, this flashlight beam hits me in the face. Where's the fire? I'm on fire. I'm on fire. And I heard this. As the flashlight beam played up and down my body, he's got poison ivy, just about the worst case I ever saw. And I looked, and I was covered from head to toe, fingertip to fingertip, and everywhere in between with red, oozing poison ivy. All right. Everybody, dig into your backpacks and get out the Calamine lotion. Roll it over to him. Don't touch him. He's still contagious. So they all dig in their backpacks. They pull out these big bottles of Calamine lotion, which is this pink stuff that stops the itching. It works. It's pretty cool. And I just poured it all over me, all over my body, my arms, my legs, my hair, everything. I found out something about Calamine lotion. It dries hard. I couldn't move. I was standing there, and Maddie came over and said, all right, you okay? I said, yeah, Maddie, I'm okay. Okay, well, we're going back to bed. What? Maddie, I can't move. All right, well, just stand there. What? Yeah, just stand. I'm going back to bed. And they all went back to sleep. They left me standing there out in the dark the burned out campfire right near the old deserted Crosby barn. There are these woodland creatures running around my toes. I was like spitting just to keep them away. Get away, get away. Sun rises. It was kind of pretty, but I was feeling a little stiff at that time. They came over, they built the campfires, they made breakfast, they fed me, they packed up the tents. Maddie came over and said, all right, time to go. Maddie, I can't walk. Really? Yeah, Maddie, I can't move. Oh, man. All right, we'll come back and get you. What? We'll come back and get you. And they took off. They left me there in the middle of the forest, right near the old deserted Crosby barn. They flew in a Boy Scout helicopter. They lowered a sky hook down. They looped it around my waist. They floated me up out of there. I was flying above the trees. I was looking down at the river. I was in my underwear. They flew me back to the campground. They lowered me down right in front of the flagpole. Somebody got out a hose and hosed me off. I got a lot of nicknames out of that. Some folks, they called me the Flying Pink Mummy. Some folks, they called me Puss. And about a week later, they called me the Human Scab. But the nickname that stuck for the rest of my time at that camp was the PI Kid. So remember this. Leaves of three, let them be.
Ah, yes. If
you think you're immune to poison ivy, think again, because poison ivy immunity may not last forever. And once you get a case, the itching never stops.
Ah, yeah. Very good advice. You know, Mark, I was thinking about when you told that story, I remember reading on your webpage, you say you do, okay, you do, in addition to the folk tales, you do these personal narratives like that one. Yeah. And you say, all of these are true, but some of them actually happened. Some of them. So are these stories, are they, how embellished are they? Are some just total fiction?
Most of them are out and out fiction. Some of them are. This particular one actually has more truth than many, because I did go to camp. There was a counselor named Maddie, a counselor named the House, and my tent mate was probably David. And
about
I did
the
get
poison ivy. Did you?
Get yes, one? I did. I did come down one summer. I came down with the most horrendous case of poison ivy ever. It really was horrible. And actually, for those of you out there who are physicians, in those days they prescribed tetracycline for poison ivy, which is one of those antibiotics that they can't use anymore because they prescribed it for everything. Anyway, the method by which I received the poison ivy rash was complete fiction.
Okay.
That story, by the way, is featured prominently in the book It Ate My Sister.
Yes.
Which I'm doing the audiobook now. If you'd want to have, we can have a short conversation. Audiobooks and storytelling are not the same thing. I've done a whole bunch of audio. I have a bunch of things out on Audible and Spotify and places like that. So go listen to those. Those are great. Some of those are live and some of those are studio recordings of stories that I tell. An audiobook, however, is, you know, I'm reading the printed page and trying as an actor to perform it. Mm-hmm. I went into a recording studio with an engineer and I recorded the whole book, got home, listened to it and went, oh, that is so boring, because it was like, you know, when I was a kid, I had an older sister. Her name was Ellen, and she was 2 years older than me, as opposed to when I'm telling you a story, which is, you know, I had this older sister. Her name was Ellen. She's 2 years older than me. And I'm actually going back and I'm re-recording the whole thing right now. It's kind of fun.
Right. Yeah. There's
a little annoying, kind of fun.
Okay, you got any other stories up your sleeve, Mark? I know you got some there.
And now for something completely different. Mm-hmm. As a storyteller, I often wonder, what is the origin of things? Many storytellers will go back to, you know, their cultural traditions, the Native Americans, the African Americans, the Jewish Americans. Me, however, I know that the person who was responsible for the origins of most things was a caveman named Ugh. Og caveman, huh? Og live in cave, huh? With dog, wolf, and wife, Marsha. Hi, I'm Marsha. Og, great hunter. Og hunt all kind of thing. In live performance, Og ask audience, what kind of thing you think Og hunt? On radio, not work so good. So, Og hunt all kind of thing. Lion, tiger, bear. Oh my! Og, greatest hunter. Og, you know, you keep saying you're a great hunter, but how come you never bring me back any elephant? Oh, Marsha, elephant very hard to catch. I know elephant's very hard to catch. That's why I want some. But Marsha, elephant very big. I know the elephant's very big. That's why I want some. Okay, Marsha, today, Og, great hunter, get elephant. Yeah, yeah, sure, sure. No, today, Og, greatest hunter, get elephant. Okay, Og, good luck with that. Bye, Og. Bye, Marsha. Og takes spear. Og go hunting. Og go through tall grass. Og see something moving. Og sneak up and... Meow. Meow. Oh, kitty cat. Too small. Go away. Og go through taller grass. Og hunting. Og see... Snake! Og hate snake. Og go through tallest grass. Og see... Elephant. Og take spear. Og get ready to throw a spear. Og trip. Og fall. Hit head on rock. Pass out cold. Og wake up. Elephant gone. No more elephant. What Og do? What Og tell Marsha? Og not know. Og go down by ocean. Sit on rock. Wave come in. Wave come out. Wave come in. Wave. Og not know what to do. Wave come in. Wave come out. Og see all these rocky things. Og pick up a few, throw in bag. Wave come in. Og get idea. Og get idea. Og tell Marsha story. Og run, 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 run. Marsha, Marsha.
What is it, Og?
Og, greatest hunter ever.
Yeah? He's such a great hunter, Og. Where's the elephant?
Oh, I'll get something better. I'll get story.
Story? What's a story?
Sit, Marsha. Og tell. Og, great hunter. Og go hunting through tall grass. Og see something roar. Lion.
Oh, no, Og. What did you do?
Ah, too small. Throw it back. Og go hunting through taller grass. Og see something. Psst, snake.
Oh, no, Og. You're terrified of snakes.
Not today, Marsha. Pick up snake. Tie snake in a knot. Throw it away. Og go hunting. Og see elephant. Og take spear. Og throw spear. Spear hit elephant. Spear bounce off elephant. Elephant turn. Elephant see Og. Og run at elephant. Elephant run at Og. Og jump on elephant. Climb up elephant head. Hold elephant ear. Ride elephant.
Wow, that's amazing.
Was amazing. Og ride elephant. Elephant roll over. Climb on Og. Og run.
Og, the elephant was on top of you.
No, not really. Elephant chase Og. Og run. Elephant chase. Og run. Elephant chase. Og see cliff. Elephant cliff.
Oh no, Og, what did you do?
Og duck.
What do you mean you duck?
Og duck.
What does a waterfowl have to do with anything?
Og get real small. Elephant run right over top. Fall off cliff. No more elephant. Sorry, Marsha.
Wow. Wow. Wow, that was amazing, Og. That was... Wait a second. How come you didn't just go to the bottom of the cliff and get me some dead elephant?
Oh. Cliff over ocean. Elephant fall in ocean. Swim away. Elephant good swimmer. Sorry, Marcia.
Oh, well, what are we gonna have for dinner?
I'll go down by ocean, find these clam thing. Ooh, tastes like a salty snot. And that story how Og, great hunter, first person eat shellfish, and first person tell story.
I love it, Mark. Yeah, I think marital relations haven't changed much the last million years.
No. There's a bunch of Og and Marcia story. I haven't told the story of how Og met Marcia. I don't think I have it in my head right now. It's one of my favorite stories for a long time is how Og met Marcia. Uh-huh. But it hasn't been told in a while. I have to think about that.
Okay, mm-hmm. So that was the first human being to eat a clam.
Yeah. Absolutely. Somebody had to be the first.
Your stories are very educational here, Mark. Learning a lot.
Yeah. Well, I live in Rhode Island, which is the ocean state, and our state bivalve is the clam. We actually have a state bivalve. Our state appetizer is the calamari, but that's another thing.
Here I thought Texas was weird.
Let me digress a little bit more about clams because I like doing that.
Okay.
I have this in fact, I have two books of Rhode Island legends that I made up, that one of which has a story in it called The Vampire Clams of Narragansett Bay.
The Vampire Clams of Narragansett Bay.
It is one of the creepiest stories. Every time I don't perform that story because it's very... I don't memorize my stories as a storyteller. Some storytellers do. I have the shape in my head. There's some rhythms and things that happen. That story is linguistically very, very tight. And every time I read it, it kind of creeps me out. Uh-huh. And the story behind the story is also kind of fun, which is one summer I learned how to clam and I went up to Cape Cod to buy a clam rake. It was this $175 clam rake. And a clam rake looks a lot like a regular rake, except really sharp. It's like a regular rake. It's the child between a regular rake and Freddy Krueger.
Okay.
Got it. And I bought it and I needed to write it off as a tax write-off. So I wrote the story of the vampire clams of Narragansett Bay.
Pretty creative.
It was a good tax write-off. Exactly.
Yeah. I used to have a farm and my accountant figured out, well, the cat food we're going to write off as pest control supply. Mm-hmm. That's a cat. Eat some money.
Yeah, that sounds good.
I think there's a statute of limitations on that by now. So that's why I say.
No, I think you might be able to justify that, keeping a cat alive to eat the mice.
That's a stretch. Sure. Now, Mark, I also saw on your webpage there some, okay, first of all, you call yourself a professional liar, and you also say you have been running for political office. So
yes.
Those two things seem to go hand in hand.
They but do. Not- when I was running for office, I did not lie. I know this politicians always say this, but I actually didn't lie on my political campaign. I've run for office twice, actually. Mm-hmm. And the first time I was running was against Patrick Kennedy. Yes, one of the Kennedys. He was in the U.S. House of Representatives. This was back with Gulf War Gulf War II must have been. And Patrick Kennedy voted for the war. Mm-hmm. He was the only one of the Rhode Island delegation who voted for the war. And I thought it was a really, really foolish thing for us to get into that second Gulf War. And it's been proven true. And nobody was saying anything. Nobody was calling him out on it. Mm-hmm. And everybody said, well, what's your qualifications for being a congressman? And I said, I know how to vote no on things. Mm-hmm. And my unofficial campaign slogan was more liberal than a Kennedy. And I actually got about a third of the vote on a budget of, I'd like to say that I got more votes per dollar spent on a campaign since 1864.
These are serious runs for office.
Oh yeah, that one was a little, I did get a meeting with him. And he did admit to having made a mistake and, you know, was working towards fixing that. The second time I ran for office, again, here in Rhode Island, Kurt Schilling, who is a former Boston Red Sox, wanted to start a video game company. And he went to our General Assembly and he managed to work out this deal where he got something like $58 million from our government to fund his video game company.
Yeah.
And I was outraged. One of my former careers is as a computer programmer. And I knew that if you gave 58 people $1 million, you'd get a much better return than giving this one guy all this money. But they did it anyway. It was one of those late night backroom deals. And the guy who was my state rep was the Speaker of the House who was behind it. And I ran against him and I lost by about 800 votes.
Wow.
It was very, very close. I was actually a little, I mean, I spent a lot of time and energy actually trying to win that campaign. Mm-hmm. And the fact that one of the polling places got shut down for a bunch of hours and all these ballots got found, he ended up winning and then he was sent to jail about 9 months later.
Oh.
For a different bribery thing.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Rhode Island.
Next time we run into you, who knows? You might be up there in Washington, D.C., huh? Are you going to run again?
That's one of, politics is a lot like heroin. Once you get hooked on it, it's really hard. I mean, it's very, very addictive.
Yeah.
And it feeds the ego. It's one of the problems with politics in general, which is you have to believe that you're the right person for the job.
Yeah.
And I know I'm not, I don't really want to sit in a meeting with a suit on and listen to these people talk, but someone's got to do it. And better me than the person who really thinks that they know what the heck they're doing and they don't.
Sure.
So yes, every time it comes around, I mean, there's an election coming up now. I was like, when they're doing something foolish, I try to stop it before it happens. That way I don't have to run for office.
Okay. Well, let fate decide.
If you want to hear one of my stories, there's a story called Old Scratch Nichols that's in the collection Dead Politician, An Undead Clam, and An Ancient Horror. And that's sort of a political humorous.
Old Scratch Nichols?
Old Scratch Nichols was a corrupt city councilman. He'd take a bribe for just about anything.
Well, Mark, it's been great having you here. Now, before we let you go, could you clue us in on any projects you have going on right now?
Absolutely. I have been so busy with creating new work. The Izzy Abramson Village Life series is a really wonderful collection of books and stories. The Village Twins will be coming out in September. A Village Romance is already out now. I highly recommend those. Mm-hmm. Also, I'm doing the audiobooks for It Ate My Sister and the Zombie Cat. That will probably be out by the time this airs. And you can find out all that stuff on my website. It's markbinderbooks.com. That's MARKBINDER books.com. Sign up for the newsletter and lots of good stories.
markbinderbooks.com. Well, thanks for being our guest today, Mark. It's been a delight and best of luck to you.
Yeah, and I hope you have me back.
I'd love to. Take care.
All right.
Well, that is our show for today, folks. We heard some great stories and some great discussion from Mark Binder.
I'd like to remind you one more time that KPFT is in the midst of a fund drive. And you can help support public radio by calling 713-526-5738, which is also 713-JAM-KPFT, or go to kpft.org and click on the donate button. With your support, you can help to ensure that KPFT will keep bringing you quality programming.
And now, in honor of Mark Binder's Poison Ivy story, we're going to close on out here with Alan Sherman singing Hello Mudda, Hello Fada. This is Eric Heen, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we want you to always remember that it's never too late to live happily ever after.
Hello Mudda, Hello Fada. Here I am at Camp Granada. Camp is very entertaining, and they say we'll have some fun if it stops raining. I went hiking with Joe Spivey. He developed poison ivy. You remember Leonard Skinner? He got ptomaine poisoning last night after dinner. All the counselors hate the waiters, and the lake has alligators. And the head coach wants no sissies, so he reads to us from something called Ulysses. No, I don't want this should scare you, but my bunkmate has malaria. You remember Jeffrey Hardy? They're about to organize a searching party. Take me home, oh Mudda Fada, take me home. I hate Granada, don't leave me out in the forest where I might get eaten by a bear. Take me home, I promise I will not make noise or mess the house with other boys. Oh, please don't make me stay. I've been here one whole day.
You're listening to The Happiness Boys, Billy Jones and Ernest Hare, and you're on the Soundbeat.
Hey, mister.
Yes?
Can you tell me where King Toot Toot and Come In Tomb is?
Why, tut, 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 my boy. You mean King Tutankhamun, too.
Attaboy.
For listeners of a certain age, a song about King Tutankhamun immediately brings Steve Martin to the Mines Theater. His King Tut mock reprimanded the commercialization of the Treasures of Tutankhamun exhibit that toured from 1976 to 79. But this one, Old King Tut, was recorded in 1923, the year after the ancient pharaoh's tomb was found. Howard Carter and company made the discovery at a time when many had abandoned the famous Valley of the Kings. Shortly after confirming the validity of their find, Carter sent a telegraph to the dig's sponsor. At last, have made wonderful discovery in Valley. A magnificent tomb with seals intact. Recovered same for your arrival. Congratulations.
His tomb instead of here was full of souvenirs.
Must have traveled greatly in his time.
Find out more at soundbeat.org. Soundbeat is produced at the Belfer Audio Archive, Syracuse University Libraries. I'm Brett Barry.
Good news, good planet, good news.
It's time now for your good news for a good planet. Project Reset. When young people get arrested, it can mean prosecution, fines, and maybe even incarceration. One mistake that could potentially ruin the rest of their lives. But in New York City, there is a second chance alternative. Project Reset is a unique diversion program from the criminal court system. Eligible 16 and 17-year-olds, first-time offenders of nonviolent misdemeanors, can now choose to enroll in 4 hours of classes instead of going to court. This progressive option to choose is a collaboration between the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, the New York Police Department, and the Brooklyn Museum of Art. Its mission is to hold young people accountable, but do it in a way that promotes human dignity and a second chance for a brighter future. Participants engage in various activities after school hours, from counseling to mock youth courts and artistic expression. They might view and discuss paintings by minority contemporary artists, then be encouraged to think about how a work of art might shift how people see them, their neighborhood, and their community. An impressive 98% of the kids successfully complete the 4-hour course and have their cases dismissed while never having set foot in a criminal court. Project Reset uses art and education to encourage teen offenders to see themselves differently, to make better choices. And this is Mandy from GoodNewsGoodPlanet.com.
This is Hank Rubichek from So What's Your Story, Wednesdays at 6 p.m. You know, KPFT Houston isn't just rich in programming, music for every taste, every genre, and talk shows that make you think and care, but it's rich in history, a media platform for our community that for over half a century represents freedom of expression and peace. Man, you got to keep those strong, right?